So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. It's hard to believe, David. I'm Nate.
I'm David.
Yeah, we are your co-hosts here on the podcast, and it's hard for me to believe that we're already at episode 11.
Right. It just feels like 2 weeks ago we started doing this.
And I'm coming off a great weekend at a big Samson retreat.
Oh, I wish I could have been there.
And got a great guest in the wings here. He's going to join us by Zoom. And thanks to the hard work of our audio wizard here standing in. Rex is out today, our regular producer. And so Tim Tan, who he also functions as, you know, the leader here, the pastor here at Crossroads of the Nations in Franklin, Tennessee. So he's at the controls. I can't wait for you to meet this guy.
I'm looking forward to it. I've heard lots of great stuff.
Yeah. Hey, how about, rather than just, shoot the shit, why don't we just go ahead and start the interview and bring him in?
There's a thought.
All right. Well, let's do that. We'll be right back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And I have been waiting for quite some time to have the recorded conversation with this friend of mine, because I know it's just going to encourage and enlighten a lot of our listeners. We're coming this week from a bit of a different angle. We've been talking a lot about alcohol addiction, alcoholism, and drug addiction. And now we're going to switch to one of my favorite subjects, sex addiction. and we have with us a guy who wrote a fantastic book called Ashamed No More. He's the director of Living Integrated in Greater Kansas City. T.C. Ryan, Tom Ryan. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Nate, David, it's so good to be with you guys. Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely. It's good to see you, Tom.
All right. Tom spoke recently at a big gathering of the Samson Society, a retreat we did in Land Between the Lakes here in Middle Tennessee. First of all, I love Tom's presence, just what he brings, the aura that he carries, a guy who truly, you can tell he's done the work because he's comfortable in his own skin, and also is very attentive to those around him. He was, Tom, I don't know whether I expressed adequately my gratitude for the way you were fully present that entire weekend, but let me just go ahead and say it, man, wherever you went, you were a healing presence, and you were there, brother. It was awesome.
Wow. Thank you. I appreciate that.
For those of our listeners who don't know your story, and I imagine a great many of them don't yet, I wonder if you could just kind of briefly for us, Tom, tell us what was the long and winding road that brought you into the rooms of recovery? I assume that, like most of us, you didn't just show up out of curiosity. Something drove you there.
Yes, I was driven is a good, great, great verb. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Nate, I grew up in Kansas City, as you know, and when we grow up, we don't get a manual on, hey, here's your family of origin, here's what life looks like, and here's what your challenges are going to be, and a few things you might want to keep in mind. We don't ever get that, and it wouldn't be age appropriate to get that anyway. I'd throw it away. But the reality is that my my house growing up, and I do need to be really clear. All my choices are my choices. You know, my road's my road. I got to own it. And that's a part of healthy, positive recovery, is the willingness to dig out and to say, well, how did I get here? Because, and for some of us, that's really an important story. That's an important piece of the story. How did I get here? And for me, there was coping with loneliness. I was an only child. There was coping with darkness I didn't understand. My mother was manic depressive, and mostly on the depressive side. She was bipolar. And my father was somebody that we now would score on the Asperger's thing. So he was a very bright man, but he was very emotionally distant. And I didn't know any of that stuff. I was a high-feeling kid, relatively intelligent, pretty neurotic, pretty anxious, pretty anxious is a good word. Mm-hmm. Struggle with my feelings, struggle with making life work. And when I got to that delicious place of adolescent exploration, and I discovered fantasy and imagination and lust and sexuality. And, you know, when I'm talking in churches, I use the phrase self-gratification, but we know it as masturbation. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered masturbation, that unlocked for me a world that was brand new. It was a world where I was the center of everything, where I could control some of the dynamics, where I could find a respite. Now we know that that's dissociating. We know that that's a way to avoid reality. That's a way to numb out pain or to find excitement. We know some of the neurochemical things that are going on in the brain. I didn't know any of those things. What I knew was I had this exhilarating experience that was intoxicating. I was puzzled by it, but I knew I wanted more. Mm. Now, in that sense, that's not that unusual from normal development, but for me, Nate, that became a go-to. And David, part of my deal is growing up in a relatively moderate Presbyterian church, good people. I had a nascent spirituality. I had a sense of awareness of God. I'd go to summer youth camp and those kinds of things. So, you know, we wouldn't have called that evangelical spirituality by any means, but there was an honest God consciousness that was operating in my soul. And it's an amazing thing when I look back. Very soon after I discovered sexual self-stimulation and exploration and all those things, I began to feel guilty and ashamed. I began to question, you know, what? Wait a minute, is this cool? This is probably not cool.
Yeah,
I was going to a youth group at a different church, and once or twice I tried to, really only once, I brought it up to a Bible study leader who was probably 2 years older than me, knowing more than I knew. But I'm so freaking neurotic, I noticed that when I brought up the topic, he blushed. And for somebody that's, you know, the way I am, introverted and lives in my head too much anyway, mm-hmm. That's the only cue I needed to just say, oh, I see how this works. We don't talk about this. Mm-hmm. I got to fix this on my own. And in that youth group, we kind of moved into an evangelical awareness. And I know that with a lot of our listeners, there's tons of issues around spirituality in church. And I respect those issues. And unfortunately, I mean, when I look at my story, I'm somebody that's actually created disappointment in others in faith communities. And so I got to own that. And I'm sorry about that. That's a part of my journey and a part of my amends. But the reality is that in our growing awareness of personal faith, there was this idea that, well, faith is really integral to everything. And maybe in my category, it was the idea that Jesus is the only thing that I really need. Jesus is all I need. Well, for an introvert and for somebody that's ashamed of his behaviors, man, that drives you into the exact opposite direction of health. And if we're talking about positive sobriety is always going to be about connection. And for me, for years, my sobriety, and I'm jumping ahead, but when I got into recovery, for so long, it was about avoiding the negative behaviors, about avoiding the path that I'd been on, about here's what I don't do, here's what I don't want to do, here's what I'm ashamed of, here's what I want to hide from, here's what I want to finish off, here's what I want to swear to God, heaven, myself, and anybody else, I will never go back to. And if you listen, that's all negative.
Right.
And I'm a devotee of Dr. Patrick Carnes, and one of the things he likes to talk about, Nate, I've heard you say this too, the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. Mm-hmm. The opposite of addiction is connection.
Right.
And what compulsive behavior does is it drives us into isolation. It drives us into fragmented living. Yeah. And that's what it did with me. So just to shorten the story, I go to the University of Missouri to get a teaching degree. I'm involved in youth ministries and young life, and that's a vibrant part of my soul. But I've got this dichotomy forming where I've got a spiritual life and some friends and robust relationships and experiences that are really drawing me out of my origins and giving me leadership opportunities. And I'm grateful. But at the same time, I've really developed this shadow side of compulsive masturbating. And once we cross that line into addiction, and I crossed it somewhere in my teen years, I became an addict early on without knowing that, without realizing that. But when we do, and when it's sex, we don't just need to continue the behavior. We need more of the behavior, and we need different of the behavior.
Right.
We get the same kind of impulse, the same kind of jazz, the same kind of buzz. It takes you to other places that you never thought you would go.
Right.
In one sense, my faith did help, restrain some of that development. I had a healthy fear of getting sick or getting arrested, and that restrained some things, but I still progressed to behaviors that were beyond just fantasy masturbation. And this continued for quite a while. Back when I was in college and then post-college, the idea in our little sub-spiritual community was kind of that, well, guys struggle with lust, but once you find the right person to marry and you start having sex, parentheses, legitimate sex, close parentheses, it's all going to go away.
Right.
And in 77, I married, I met a girl and convinced her to marry me. And in 78, she married me, Pam, and it did. It all went away. It was miraculous. It was awesome. But I was the same guy.
Right.
And when the ways of life came back into the creek banks in the normal ways, and I got bored or I got stressed out or I got distracted, I started going back to the same stuff. Yes. And that began this journey of me struggling to try and maintain my public and private life that's healthy and tolerate, hate, detest, restrain, put away, but deal with on my own.
Right.
Mm-hmm. This private negative life. And it didn't work.
Yeah. Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure, sure, please.
Because I want to pick up where you are right there. But going back to your youth group experience, when you were, 12, 13, 14, 15, and you had the experience where, you brought it up once and the youth leader blushed and you realized this was not safe. This is kind of taboo and there's not apparently a permissible way to think about this. What would, or do you think it would have made a difference if someone had told you that these are permissible thoughts, that this is permissible behavior within an understanding that, you could have come to terms with. It's not shameful behavior. And if you were to give yourself permission to have the thought, have the feeling, experience what you needed to experience and move on from it, would that have empowered do you think that would have diffused some of the mystique about this? Or do you think it would have perpetuated your behavior further on into addiction sooner?
Oh, that's a profound question. I actually don't know what the real, my guess is, David, that if I'd met that kind of input, I think that would have lessened the shame for sure. Mm-hmm. I think that would have given me the invitation to personal acceptance. I don't think it would have solved everything because as I look back, I had these underlying issues. I mean, yeah, that's the thing about any addiction, chemical or process addiction, any of it, it's always a symptom of something deeper. that we're struggling with in our souls, usually unrecognized. And mm-hmm. and that was certainly my case. But I do think that would have taken some of the power of isolation, some of the power of shame away. I think that would have invited me into a self-awareness that would have allowed me to maybe bridge that gap from isolation into community, into sooner, for right. sure. And maybe before I went to seminary, which would have been really helpful. Now, I am talking about the 70s, so that's the dark ages of sex addiction understanding. Dr. Carnes was doing his work, but very few of us really understood that kind of stuff. And so, but, you know, I think that would have been helpful. Yeah, I think that kind of, and if you bring that forward today, you know, what I'm talking about is kind of our classic understanding of somebody who had early stage trauma, early stage deprivation, abandonment stuff. So you got a kid with a dented soul, and then he stumbles upon an addictive process. In my case, it was sex. Mm-hmm. And that helps him cope with his feelings, cope with life, and avoid feelings and avoid life. And but gives him some satisfaction. That's of course diminishing, but helps him live the lie and live in the shadows. And that's a classic where you've got first the trauma and then you've got the discovery of addiction. Today, as you guys know, we've got a whole generation of kids that probably are coming from a lot of them from relatively healthy families. They're not suffering abuse. They're not suffering, you know, abandonment issues. No family's perfect, but they've got parents that care. They've been raised in good situations, but they live in a sex-crazed culture, and technology's changed so much that they're offered the opportunity of exploring erotic imagery before their natural exploration age would indicate an interest in that. So you got 11 and 10 and 9 and 8 and 7-year-olds seeing these adult bodies engaged in behaviors that are troubling and fascinating, because at any age, we're fascinated with ourselves, we're fascinated with sex, we're fascinated with human bodies.
Right.
And so kids that start seeing and watching pornography and other explorations of sex are having a formation put upon them. Mm-hmm. And some of them can abuse it, not unlike, you know, the college frat boy that abuses alcohol for a while, but then decides he needs to finish his major and grow up and get a job, and he stops abusing alcohol. He doesn't become the alcoholic.
Right.
But others get hooked. Others, maybe it's genetic. Maybe there's a DNA curse. Maybe there's something else hidden in the psychology of the family system. Maybe it's just in this person's psychology, but they get hooked. And that's happening with a lot of kids. Mm-hmm. Because where I think sex is a little bit different, and you know, you guys know I'm not a therapist. I did go through the certification process in Carnes' organization. So I'm what they call a pastoral sex addiction professional supervisor.
Wow.
That's a five big words. Doesn't really take you directly anywhere. And it's not worth any qualitative or quantitative increase in my income, but it's nice to be able to say. And I'm being a little silly. The reality is that was great training, because it did help me with my own recovery, and it helped me understand a lot more the dynamics. So we got a whole generation, here's my point, that are afflicting their own brains and putting themselves in isolating patterns of behavior. Because if you trip that wire of, I need this, I love this, I want more, if you move into those three key categories of becoming preoccupied, and then losing control, and then suffering some negative life consequences. Mm-hmm. Then we've got a whole generation that's doing this to themselves, where it's not necessarily family of origin issues. They need the same thing that any of us in recovery need. They need honesty. They need community. They need the truth. They need invitations to become real. They need help in terms of understanding how they got to where they are.
And, right.
So back to your point, I think that it would have made a difference. It would have helped me with the shame, with the isolation. It would have fast-tracked my permission to pursue some kind of external help. And once we become addicts, we all need external help.
Right. And do you think that that was the beginning of your realization that you may need a persona to take with you through life, because the real you wasn't maybe going to be welcome?
That is exactly when that happened, and except that I wasn't consciously aware. Mm-hmm. Persona, oh, this is how I have to behave. But that is exactly what happened. This is what's acceptable. This is who I need to be. This is the face I need to show. Yeah. And in my case, spirituality was a dual-edged sword because on the one hand, like I said, it was very sincere. I had a sincere faith and still do. I'm grateful for that. It did restrain some of my behaviors. But on the other hand, it was important that I be a certain way. And all the more so when I became a pastor. It's just not acceptable to struggle with these things if you're going to be in ministry.
Yeah, because our personas don't start when we're 30 and we realize that, you know, something doesn't work. They start when we're 12 and we realize that the questions we're asking aren't okay anymore. Feeling or experiencing. So yeah, I appreciate you elaborating on that because those are, in my world, that those are important points that I explore with people all the time.
Yeah.
People always think their personas come in and, you know, when they develop the addiction, and they're not. You really peel back the onion and you realize we've had to perform since we were 7, you know? Yeah. Anyway, yeah, thanks for unpacking that.
Yeah, so Tom, let's go back and pick up the story. I'm tracking with you in kind of an unusual way because I too got married, Allie, and I got married in 78 and went on the seminary track, the whole deal. So I'm superimposing my own story over yours, but I'll pick it up.
But we do share a lot. So I met Pam, we married, left Young Life staff. I'd been on Young Life staff for about a year. And we went out to a seminary in the West Coast, Fuller, and did 2 years there and then a year at Princeton. So we were at Princeton similar times, but I lived off campus. I wasn't a matriculated student, and I loved Princeton. That was a good experience. Came back to the Midwest and was an assistant pastor, and then went to another church, was an executive pastor, and then started a church in 1989. So I'm not somebody that I would think of as a good church planter candidate, but there were dynamics afoot in the congregation I was serving that seemed to be the path to go. So in 1989, we started a church, and 4 years into that, I'm just coming apart, guys. I'm trying to manage this thing. We're raising 4 little kids, and I can't handle it. And this is a good move on my part. And I bit down really hard on myself. I was scared to death, but I went to a therapist whom I'd met and got the idea he was safe. And I did choose wisely. This was not a guy trained in sex addiction, but he knew enough. And he'd read Out of the Shadows by Patrick Carnes, and he recognized the dynamics. And so he started me on the path of recovery. And that was great. And I want this story, every time I tell it, to be, and then it began to be this long journey of 2 steps forward and a half step back, but I got to sustain sobriety. And by the way, I continue to grow my church and bless my family. And I'm a success story. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't my story. I learned a lot. I became a better leader. I became a better preacher. I became a better pastor. But right or wrong, our little accountability circle, a year after going to this guy, disclosed voluntarily to Pam my whole struggle. So we're 15 years in marriage, and I'm telling her my story. And guys, I need to tell you, that was the last time I voluntarily disclosed.
Yeah.
Subsequently, every time that it would come out, it was because she discovered or she intuitively knew I was struggling, would ask me until I was ashamed and couldn't hide it. And I'm not a good liar. In that sense, I'm not that good an addict. I'm really not. But I did tell her a year after seeing the therapist, and my wife's not highly codependent. She's got uncommon practical wisdom. And so she went to see my therapist the next day, talked to him, came back and said, "Give me the book," meaning Out of the Shadows by Carnes. And she went to school on what this was all about. What was this third entity in her marriage? She knew I was angry. She knew I was depressed, but she didn't know why. Now she knew why. And she came to the terms with the idea very early on that if Tom wants to work at his recovery, we got a chance. But that's Tom's job, not mine. And if Tom doesn't want to work at his recovery, we don't have a chance. And that'll make me sad. And he's a father of my children. And I always want him to do well, but I'm not going to live crazy. And we sculpted a little support group around us. And they were very supportive and very understanding, committed in the same ways, same values that we had. And their counsel was stay in ministry. keep working at your recovery. This is important. You need to be in ministry. That's what you're called to do. You're good at it. You'll be even better at it when you get to the other, a higher level of recovery. But looking back, in my case, if I could go back and change one thing, I would yank me out and have just severed my relationship with functioning ministry at that point, and I would have gone to treatment. I was a severe enough case. I needed treatment. I needed to go to a treatment place where I unplugged from life for a good 60 to 120 days.
Yeah.
And learned what I needed to learn and do some exhaustive excavation of family system stuff and come to terms with what my practices have been that were detrimental and discover what my really true values were and who I really was and who I wanted to be and right. and start to learn the new skills and then come back and I wouldn't put me back in church. A lot of people I would put back in service. In that case, I probably would put me in a place where I could fly under the radar for quite a while and build the right support structures and just change patterns. Cause I had such established lifelong patterns that were so entrenched in my soul. And so, but we didn't do that. Treatment wasn't an option. I was in a conservative denomination. I'm not making excuses, but this is the reality for a lot of people who are in ministry. There just aren't options to treatment. There aren't options to therapy and they're scared to death of disclosure because if it comes out, you've lost your income. You've lost your ability to provide for your family. You've lost your sense of identity, the only sense that's positive because the other sense of your identity is all negative. Mm-hmm. And so everything is steered towards, you know, try and stay where you are. And our accountability circle was very adamant about that, very clear about that. Yeah. But what ensued was a bunch of years where it was just up and down and up and down. And I do well and then I'd slip and I'd get discovered by Pam and we'd work through those things. I'd make my amends. I'd work at recovery. I started going to group. I started a group for ministers in the Kansas City area. It's very private and confidential that were struggling with addiction. I started working with a different therapist who was very experienced in these things. He was helpful, but there were hidden underlying issues that we couldn't crack, and that simply going to 12-step groups and working at my recovery, I was just going around and around and around. The metaphor that I like to use is that it was like trying to fix an airplane in flight that really needed to be pulled into the overhaul hangar. And wow. I was losing altitude and engines were catching on fire and alarms were going off in the cockpit. And I crashed in 2008. I just couldn't keep it up anymore. And there was a spring afternoon where a meeting was canceled. And ironically, at the time I was on antidepressant, which had a side effect that just caused me to not be able to function physically in any sexual way. But the brain is the biggest sex organ in our bodies. I'm distracted. I just want to buzz. I just want to think about something else. And I went out to a park, and long and short of it is I got arrested. Mm-hmm. And I was charged with a misdemeanor for lewd and lascivious behavior. And, you know, in my spiritual community, that is not a cool thing. You're not supposed to ever be charged with a misdemeanor and be arrested. And I spent 26 hours in jail, and my wife had to come bail me out, and that was painful, and I had crashed. It was going to be all over. It was all over.
Yeah.
But it was going to be in the papers and just this horrible, horrible end. And I've got a very dear friend whom Pam called the night I called her from jail, and she called him, she called my sponsor, she called my therapist, and he began to pray, God, would you please keep this out of the papers? And however you score spirituality or think about divine intervention, if there is such a thing, it's a mystery as to why some things are permitted and why some things are interrupted. But for whatever reason, it never got into the papers.
Wow.
So we had the privilege of resigning our position. Now my accountability circle said, okay, you've got to get out. But at the next board meeting, I resigned. But they said, you know what? For 10 days, the God's kept it out of the papers. If you tell your board why you're resigning, explicitly, you'll put it in the papers. So why don't you tell your board that the truth, you're struggling, tell them enough so that they get the gist and do that. And that's what I did. I said, yeah, you guys know that I'm struggling with depression, anxiety, and childhood issues. You know, I'm a head case. And they go, Tom, the whole church knows these things. You're a pretty transparent preacher. So what's the point? And I said, I'm engaging in self-destructive behaviors, and they're going to really hurt the church, and they're going to take me totally out of the game if I don't resign. The therapist I'm working with has one last strategy to help me, and to do it, I've got to resign, but I'm engaging in behaviors that are going to really hurt us all if I don't quit ministry, and it's not ministry's fault. It's my fault. Mm-hmm. So they let me resign 3 months later, and then we engage in an intensive outpatient work. And I have a sponsor who's just brilliant. So I met with him, and I met with my therapist twice a week, and we engaged in some cognitive behavior therapy and dialectical behavior therapy. But we also used a new thing that he was trained in called EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. Right. And EMDR works with people that have suffered with trauma and resulting compartmentalization in their cognitive process, meaning it could be a war person returning from Iraq or Afghanistan who's suffered the traumas of war, and EMDR can help him mm-hmm. as his brain heals and cools to process the trauma and the impact and the feelings mm-hmm. and the threats involved. But it also works well for people that have been victims of crime or have struggled with early childhood mm-hmm. abuse things. And that was my case. And what happened, guys, was over the next year, and it was a full year. So this was a very draining exercise. And I had about 7 months of severance that the church gave me. So that's what made this possible.
Wow.
Was that my healing began to really take hold. And my brain really began to be able to process and handle information and feelings and impulses, because the impulses did come back, handle them in a different way. And when I got arrested, I had done so much hurt to our marriage, it really was over. And I know in her heart of hearts for Pam, there was a sense of grief, profound humiliation, because we're losing this church that we pastored for 19 years and it was our family. Fear for the embarrassment and humiliation of our children. And then grief that just, she'd been on this journey with me now for all these years, 15 years. And I never gotten to where we both wanted me to get and where she really believed I wanted to get. And now it was ending this way. But she too knew that sooner or later, she would probably take the exit, because, I mean, you just can't keep doing this. I'd done too much damage. About a year into the process, because she is wise and has a lot of common sense, she took her time, and she knew, you know, Kansas City's not a big town. As soon as she filed for divorce, it'd be out, and then there'd just be a lot of, okay, what happened?
Yeah.
So she's just waiting for the right moment, and then she starts to see this change in my life. And she had to face that really hard decision of, do I take one more chance on this guy mm-hmm. and on this process? And she chose to do that. And I'm grateful that she did. I wouldn't expect that of any spouse or of her, but I'm grateful and humbled by that. And I think if you asked her, she'd say, yes, that was the right decision. And yes, it paid off, because here we are 10 years later. And I can tell you, while it's not a spotless sobriety, while it's not perfect, I'm living a life I had totally lost hope I could ever live. I'm living in a way I never thought I could live, handling life in ways that had befuddled me for years, and find myself useful to others, connected with a lot of others, got a lot of growing still to do, but recovery really does work, and my life is the light's on. The light's on, the colors are vibrant. I can see, I can feel. I'm still frustrated with myself. I still have, as I said, a lot of growing to do, but I'm in the game, guys, and I'm useful to others and feeling grace. In those many dark years where I was in recovery but not getting to where I wanted to go, my friend Joe would say to me at lunch, because I was very honest with him, and Joe would say, can you find joy? Where's joy? And I had to almost grasp at what the right answer would be. Well, my kids are my joy. My wife is my joy. You know, the privilege of pastoring is my joy. You know, but he knew I was giving the right answer. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't speaking from my heart, because frankly, the joy cylinder in my heart was just empty. It was just dead. It was just deadened. Mm-hmm. Come forward to today, and I've got moments where I just find myself start laughing. And it's at a leaf, at our puppy, at something Pam says, at our kids, at just walking down the street, at some goofy thing that I do, being able to laugh. And I recognize, oh, wait a minute, that's joy. That's just joy at being alive.
Yeah. And Tom, that's a really great, great point, because we have a thing in our practice that we call the neurology of joy. And that is, you know, just even the physiology of addiction, when the limbic system and the amygdala and all that stuff start to diminish as we get into recovery and sobriety, the prefrontal cortex that experiences joy, creates opportunities to have joy, begins to come back to life. Because while you've been in fight or flight mode with anxiety, shame, and trauma, the prefrontal cortex has been diminishing its function. It doesn't, you know, you're not you. And as you, I love that you're pointing out that as you got healthier, and as that, there's a physiological change that happens in the brain, and you become you again, and you get the capacity eventually to experience joy. And that's how you know things are, one way anyway, that we know things are changing. So that's a, you know, it's a spiritual shift. It's a physiological shift. It's behavioral, certainly, but the behavior is not, you know, where we start. But yeah, that's awesome. What was, like, for the people that are listening that are embarking on this really early on, what would be one of the first things you could tell them to anticipate in their recovery, especially particularly where sexual addiction is concerned?
Oh, yeah. I think resistance. And I think being surprised by where the resistance comes from. Mm-hmm. There'll be resistance just in the life we've you said that just beautifully, David. I was just listening to what you were talking about in terms of prefrontal cortex and those dynamics in the brain. There is such a narrowing of our lives. And the longer we're compulsive and the longer we keep practicing in these self-rewarding, self-isolating ways, and they're self-shaming, the more narrow life becomes. And so when you start to broaden that life and kick against those boundaries that we've inadvertently imposed upon ourselves, those boundaries create resistance. They're hard to break through. Right. But there, if we're honest, and this is where the complexity of our human spirituality, which whatever our dogma, whatever our background, whatever name we give to it, doesn't really matter. We're all brothers and sisters who share this human dynamic that's fascinating and puzzling. And we have the capability of singing like angels and barking like demons. We have this interior capability of being our own worst enemy. And there, resistance can come there too. And that might be the most surprising. We might look to external ways, but I think one of the first words is be aware of, you will have resistance. This is not perfect. One of the old recovery slogans is so important. It's progress, not perfection. And I heard that slogan and I recognized the truth of it. But the fact is, deep on levels that I didn't understand in my soul, was the need to be perfect. The need to perform in such a way as to be okay. The need to deliver a certain persona and a certain effect from the reality of that persona so that others would say, wow, you know, that Tom, he's something. Wow. Okay. And that, and nothing less than that would make my survival possible. Now, guys, we know that's a lie. That's a huge lie. And if I said that out loud, I would just go, oh, you know, here's how that's wrong psychologically. Here's how that's wrong emotionally. Here's how that's wrong intellectually, here's how that's wrong humanly, here's how that's wrong biblically, here's how that's wrong spiritually. But that still was so deeply embedded in me that I had to break out of that. And it's progress. It really is progress. And any step forward is going to have a little bit of resistance, but it's a step forward. And we have to cultivate this willingness to say, I want to live a life I can respect. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's what I would say to somebody that's early on in this recovery is, first and foremost, you got to anchor yourself to your willingness to do whatever it takes to live a life you can respect. This really is about your true self. This really is about you taking care of you. This really is about you discovering what you got to learn about how you got here without shaming yourself. Have you made mistakes you're ashamed of? I certainly have. Nate, you mentioned the title of the book I wrote, Ashamed No More. That's InterVarsity's title, Ashamed No More. The working title I gave him was Shame No More, meaning let's not shame each other anymore. Oh, I need to not shame myself anymore. And I love that InterVarsity was willing to publish my book. I'm grateful for that. But the title implies that I got to a place where I'm not struggling with shame. And that's just not true. That I struggle with that on a regular basis. But the deeper work is that willingness to do whatever it takes to be honest to ourselves. And in that honesty, find out who we really are and discover that we're somebody worth living a life that we really respect.
Yeah.
Wow.
Tom, the name of your nonprofit is Living Integrated.
Living Integrated. So I have a group here in Kansas City that's a group of guys that we try and... I love all of the sex addiction recovery groups in our country, and I'm grateful for each and every one of them. And for a lot of years, I went to an SCA group or an SLAA group here in Kansas City. I've also participated in SA groups, so I'm a fan. But what I wanted to do was explore, could you do one that was anchored to a church, not my own, and with Jesus as the identified higher power and competent recovery practices. And that's the Living Integrated group. We're trying to help people that are coming from a Christian spirituality background, and that will bring a lot of baggage and issues, by the way, integrate their spirituality with healthy recovery practices. And then what's involved is we developed a nonprofit and a board, and we've just now opened up our website. It's nascent. It's early stage, so be kind if you look at it, but you can find Living Integrated on the web, livingintegrated.org. And if anybody wants to get a hold of me, I mean, right now we're working on our email connection. It's there, but you just can't see it. You can get me at connect@livingintegrated.org. Excuse me. Connect@livingintegrated.org.
I love, by the way, that you chose the word integrated and didn't default to integrity.
Tell me why.
Growing up, you know, in an evangelical culture, you know, I longed for integrity, and integrity in all those years was defined for me as purity, as the guy who just makes no slips. It's all walking in the light. There's no shadow.
Perfect. Yeah.
Really, integrity comes from the same root as integration. Dark and light together. Not hiding. And until I was willing to own the shadow.
Yeah.
And give up that unrealistic dream that I am always going to be, I'm always going to do the pure thing, the right thing. I'm not going to, that actually is a goal to which I can realistically aspire.
Yeah.
That I'm always going to make the right choice. Boy, man. I chased that rabbit for a very long time.
He's a fast rabbit. You'll never catch him. Yeah, absolutely.
And how wonderful it is. How wonderful it is to be able to sit in a room with other people and talk honestly about light and shadow.
Yes. Yeah.
And reaffirm my desire to walk in the light, to live in the light, and never to glorify or excuse anything that might take place in the shadow, but never feel the need to hide it either.
Right.
And it really, it's in my owning of the shadow that I'm most able to connect with other people, because we're all walking around with those conversations that we're not having, we desperately need to have.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm glad you picked up on that. Thanks. Yeah.
Beautiful.
There's a Christian mystical writer. I'm not that familiar with the mystics, but her name's Julianne of Norwich. And Richard Rohr and others have picked up on this great quote that I love from her. First, there is the fall, and then there is the recovery from the fall, but both are the mercy of God.
Yeah.
And there's something in that quote that rings deeply true, that my better soul, my true self goes, yes, yes, that's right. But Nate, in that performance thing that we grew up with, that is not right. No.
Yeah.
The recovery and the fall is not the mercy of God.
Need
mercy. But then we move into this crazy place of mercy's great and forgiveness is great, but now I've got to perform. That's the trap. That's the trap that will always kind of loop us back and keep us going back and get it frustrated. And we get frustrated, then we're just primed for wanting to go back to our drug of choice and just numb out for a while.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, this has been such an enlightening and inspiring conversation. I know that it's going to spark a great deal of thought among our listeners. And just to repeat, if you want to get in touch with Tom Ryan, T.C. Ryan, as he's known in the great world of publishing. The book is Ashamed No More, and you can reach Tom at connect@livingintegrated.org. Tom, thanks so much. I always enjoy spending time with you. Look forward to the next time we can be in the same room.
Feelings mutual. David, great being with you. Thank you, my friend. Absolutely. Great to be with you guys.
All right.
Great talking with you.
Well, hang with us. We'll be back in a moment here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
And welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Nate, that was a really fruitful time with this guy. And
I knew it would be, man. And you know, if... what Tom says is true, and I believe it is, that the opposite of addiction is connection. One thing that I see in Tom is an ability to connect.
Yeah.
In a healthy way.
Mm-hmm.
I watched him over the weekend be there and connect with the men who had come for, you know, counsel and encouragement, and, mm-hmm. you know, wisdom and insight.
Right.
And, I loved watching Tom connect with you and you connect with Tom. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, I can trust this guy and we can have an honest conversation.
Right, yeah. The gift of accessibility.
yeah. Well, I do hope that those of our listeners to whom this topic applies mm-hmm. will take an action step.
Yeah.
And do some of what Tom suggests, or maybe even reach out to Tom. Mm-hmm. Or if you know somebody who you just kind of have some concern about, or maybe they've trusted you enough to talk about what's going on mm-hmm. Behind the curtain in their life, feel free to pass this episode along. We do, by the way, we greatly appreciate when you share the link to this podcast.
Sure
when
do.
You give us a rating on iTunes, that'll help drive us higher in the listings.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, we'd love to hear your thoughts and your suggestions, even your pushback. You can always contact us by email at positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com. That's mm-hmm. positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, go ahead. Those emails.
That. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that wraps it up. You've got to get back to see more of your clients.
I have people
today. Oh, man. And no shortage of people lining up outside your door.
No, not now.
Yeah.
It's a busy season, too. This is a tough season we're going into with the holidays for many of us that struggle with all kinds of ways of medicating our lonely heart.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are going to record next week, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And we have a lady that will join us next week with an incredible story coming out of human trafficking and what she's doing coming into recovery and helping people get out of human trafficking.
Holy smokes. Okay.
Yeah, incredible.
All right. Well, until next week then, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
And we are your trusted traveling companions here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.